Greetings and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle. I'm the pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this brief episode, we're going to be taking a look at the issues related to the Eusebian canons, the ending of Mark, and textual criticism, especially with relation to passages like Mark 15, verse 28, and Luke 23. Verse 34a. So in this episode, I want to give some reflections, and I've jotted down some notes that were taken from some recent reading that I was doing through a book by a scholar named Francis Watson. And the book that I completed reading, of course, since I teach regularly classes on the Gospels, I'm often doing reading on the Gospels. But anyways, this is his book that is titled The Fourfold Gospel, subtitled A Theological Reading of the New Testament Portraits of Jesus. And this was published by Baker Academic in 2016. And as that subtitle that I just read indicates, a theological reading of the New Testament portraits of Jesus, this volume offers a series of theological reflections on the four Gospels and their relationship to one another. The author, Francis Watson, is a New Testament scholar at Durham University in the UK, and he's certainly a mainstream scholar. I wouldn't agree with him on very much, about many things related to the study of the Gospels. He, holds to Markan priority. He would embrace modern textual criticism. I'm not endorsing his scholarship wholesale. I don't agree with everything, certainly, but I still think that this book was useful. It provided a lot of very helpful insights into understanding the four Gospels. One aspect of this book that was unique is the fact that in the second half of it in particular, Watson gives emphasis to how the so-called Eusebian canons were used by ancient readers of the New Testament Gospels, and how the Eusebian canons reflect ancient pre-critical ways of understanding and interpreting the fourfold gospel. So, what are the Eusebian canons? As the name indicates, the Eusebian canons, these were a series of canons or tables, literary or reading aids for the gospels that were produced by Eusebius of Caesarea, who lived from around the year 260 to around the year 340. And of course, we best know Eusebius as the so-called father of church history. He wrote the Ecclesiastical History, which is an essential source for understanding the history of Christianity in the first 300 years of the movement. And I previously, many of you know, did a series where I read completely through Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History, and I offered notes and commentary on each chapter within that. That's available on sermonaudio.com for those who want to just listen to Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History. So, anyways, Eusebius composed these canons for understanding the New Testament Gospels. And the canons are essentially a cross-referencing system or an attempt to harmonize the four canonical gospels. And this was done long before the development of modern printed Bibles with their chapter and verse divisions and their in-text cross-references. So this was a way for ancient readers of the four gospels to compare them one with another, similar passages and so forth. And so Eusebius himself didn't invent his canons from scratch, but he used an earlier a system that was developed by someone named Ammonius of Alexandria. And Eusebius's canons, though, were used for probably, from the time he composed them in the early 4th century for about 1,000 years until the introduction of modern printing. They appeared often in Greek copies of the Gospels, in ancient translations of the Gospels. And so they indeed did have, a big influence in ancient reading of the Gospels. And the canons of Eusebius also do appear. They are printed in the Nestle-Aland 28th edition. If you have an NA28, and you open it up to the front matter, to the introduction, I'm looking here at my own copy of this, and it begins on page 89 in the introduction. It starts with Eusebius's epistle or letter to someone named Carpianus, and here in the NA28, it's in Greek, and this letter to Carpianus, often associated and was a preface to the canons because it provides a layout of what the canons are about. And we'll talk about this book in just a minute, but there's another book that I'm in the process of reading by Jeremiah Coogan. He provides an English translation of Eusebius's epistle to Carpianus. And then after that letter, you have the canons that are listed in NA 28, Nestle-Aland 28, beginning on page 90 and going through to page 94. And this is the immediate preface to reading the Greek text of the New Testament in the NA 28. And I'm not sure when Nestle-Aland started to reprint the Eusebian canons, but there they are. And so there are some 10 separate canons that are listed, and what they do is they group various passages in the Gospels along with their parallels. And so Canon 1 has passages that appear in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Canon 2 has passages that appear in the first three Gospels, what we sometimes call the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And et cetera. So it goes. Canon 3 has passages that are in Matthew, Luke, and John. Canon 4 has passages in Matthew, Mark, and John. Canon 5 has passages only in Matthew and Luke, what modern scholars who hold to Markan priority and the four-source hypothesis, they would say these were two places where Mark and Luke agree. Canon 6 has passages where Matthew and Mark are in agreement, parallels in Matthew and Mark. Canon 7, Matthew and John. Canon 8, Luke and Mark. Canon 9, Luke and John. And then Canon 10 has four subcanons. Canon 10 has a listing of passages that are unique to each gospel. So in Canon 10, again, it's got four subcanons. It lists all the passages that are unique to Matthew, that are unique to Mark, that are unique to Luke, that are unique to John. And so each one of these passages has a number assigned to it. And if you look at the Nestle-Aland 28th edition, at the Greek text itself, on the inside margin, it lists these canons. And again, it lists the passages, and there's a top number, which is the passage, and then there's a bottom number, which tells you the canon where the passage is found. So if you can, you're reading through the Greek New Testament in Nestle-Aland, it's got the Eusebian canons, you're at a passage, you can see the bottom number is going to be the canon it is, and then there's a number that's given to locate the passage. And then you can compare that with the passage as it appears in another one of the Gospels, if there is a parallel. So, anyways, this was a rather ingenious way that ancient readers of the Gospels could compare various passages in these so-called Eusebian canons. And it seems that there has been a revival of interest in recent years in these canons, in the examination of them, in the study of them, and the study of how they influence early Christian readers, early Christian reception of the Gospels, early Christian interpretation, understanding of the fourfold gospel evidences in the New Testament. And some, I think, are even giving Eusebius credit and his canons for solidifying the canonical reception and consensus of the fourfold gospel, as opposed to something like Tatian's De Tessarum. Eusebius gave a way to read the fourfold gospel and to compare the passages without trying to do what Tatian did and just push them all together into one book. I mentioned already that I'm in the process of reading this book, which just came out from Oxford University Press in 2023, this year. It's titled Eusebius the Evangelist, subtitled Rewriting the Fourfold Gospel in Late Antiquity by Jeremiah Coogan. I've only started just barely to read it, the introduction, and I'm hoping I'll read the rest of it. Perhaps I'll write a book review of it. So, why this podcast? Well, I mentioned first that I was reading this book, and Watson makes reference to the Eusebian canons and how they might be used for interpreting and understanding the Gospels. And if you've ever done any research or study relating to the traditional ending of Mark, you've probably heard someone make mention of the Eusebian canons, even if you weren't familiar with them. And the reason is that one of the common arguments against the authenticity of the ending of Mark is that it does not appear in the Eusebian canons. That is, when Eusebius did his canons, he did not list numbers and canons for the various passages in Mark 16, verses 9 through 20. And so some scholars say, aha, it's not authentic because it wasn't in the Eusebian canons. Now, when we look at Eusebius, we are well aware that Eusebius knew of controversy relating to Mark 16, 9 through 20. One key piece of evidence is a letter that we have from Eusebius, which is called the Letter to Marinus, in which he discusses the fact that the ending of Mark was being disputed by some in his day. Interestingly enough, the dispute, according to this letter, wasn't about Mark 16, 9 through 20, whether it was authentic or not. The dispute or the problem, as Eusebius lays it out in that letter, related to harmonizing the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Mark with respect to the timing of the resurrection. And so apparently there were some early readers who thought they saw a conflict in Matthew and Mark with respect to what day the resurrection took place, because in Matthew 28:1, it begins at the end of the Sabbath. And so some took that to mean not that Christ was raised on the first day of the week, at the end of the Sabbath having ended, but that the resurrection took place at the close of the Sabbath. Whereas if you look at Mark 16, verse 2, it says, "And when the Sabbath was passed," and in Mark 16, 9, part of the traditional ending says, "Now when Jesus was risen early the first day of the week." And so the controversy that Eusebius discusses in the letter to Marinus, and the reason some people were troubled by Mark 16, 9 through 20, was that they perceived a contradiction between Matthew's account and Mark's account. And Matthew was the premier gospel, the most read gospel. even Eusebius's canons, taken over from Ammonius, use Matthew as the standard. And so if there's going to be some question about the chronology of Matthew versus the chronology of Mark, Matthew is going to be the gospel that is going to be given a pride of place. So the letter to Marinus tells us that Eusebius knew of controversy over the traditional ending of Mark. And that controversy would last for another couple hundred years. In the article that I published a few years ago called The Ending of Mark as a Canonical Crisis, which you can find at my academia.edu page, I pointed out that for the first 300 years, there's really no evidence of controversy over the traditional ending of Mark. It's mentioned in Justin Martyr. It's there in Irenaeus of Lyon and is against heresies. And then the first evidence, the earliest evidence of controversy, is this letter from Eusebius to Marinus. And then we have just two uncial manuscripts that end at Mark 16:8, Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. And that's evidence of controversy. And they're also mid-fourth century. And this controversy lasts till about 500, I suggest. And after that, the consensus that had existed in the first 300 years is restored up until the modern period, where with the advent of modern historical criticism and modern textual criticism in the 19th century, the traditional ending of Mark is once again challenged. So my point simply is that the absence of the traditional ending in the Eusebian canons, them not having a listing of passage and canon parallels to the other gospels, although this is given as an argument against the authenticity of the traditional ending, it's not as solid an argument against it as one might think, given the evidence we have in the letter to Marinus. And another just observation, as I was thinking about this, having read these two part of well, one book entirely, Watson's book, and starting to read Coogan's book, is the Eusebian canons were used extensively again from mid fourth century to the 14th century, pre the invention of printing. But they were used, and the traditional ending of Mark appears in the vast majority of extant manuscripts of the Gospel of Mark. And so I haven't done the extensive study of it, but I'm imagining there's the Eusebian canons that don't list parallels for Mark 16, 9 through 20, but Mark 16, 9 through 20 is still included in these Greek manuscripts, witnesses to the Gospel of Mark, along with ancient versions and translations. So the thing that though that came to my attention as I read through Watson's book, the thing that struck me is a point that he makes about the Eusebian canons, not necessarily with respect to the traditional ending of Mark, but in several places in this book. He makes reference to the fact that in the Eusebian canons, there are passages whose authenticity has been challenged by modern critics. It's not a main focus of this book, but it's just something I observed in the discussion and was struck by. So let me just give you two examples of this. The first example is from Mark 15, verse 28. And Mark 15, 28 reads as follows. This is from the Authorized Version based on the TR. And the scripture was fulfilled, which saith, and he was numbered with the transgressors. And that's a fulfillment citation, and it's drawn from Isaiah 53, 12, interpreting the events in the Passion of Christ. He was numbered with the transgressors. This verse, Mark 15, 28, is one of those that doesn't appear in the modern critical text. If you're reading a modern translation based on the modern critical text, it's going to go from verse 27 to verse 29, and verse 28 might be in the footnotes, but it's not in the modern critical text, and so it likely doesn't appear in many modern translations. The assumption of modern textual critics is that it was inserted, Mark 15:28 was an insertion that was meant to harmonize with Luke 22:37. And Luke 22:37 reads, "For I say unto you that this that is written must yet be accomplished in me, and he was reckoned among the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end." And this is Christ quoting Isaiah 53 and verse 12. And so the modern critic says, aha, the scribes added to Mark 15:28, what was there in Luke 22:37. This was a harmonization. And here's the thing that struck me, though. Watson, in his book on the Gospels, points out that Mark 15:28 is listed in the Eusebian canons. It's in Canon 8, and Canon 8 is a listing of the parallels between Mark and Luke. And so if you looked at the Eusebian canons, you would find there that there's a listing for Mark 15:28 in Canon 8. It's passage 216, and its parallel is given in that canon with Luke 22:37, which is listed as passage 277 in Luke's gospel. So this is not to say that Watson accepts the authenticity of Mark 15:28. In fact, he says in his comments on the passage that he thinks it is transplanted from Luke. You can see this on page 154. Still, it's striking that the Eusebian canons are a witness in favor of the inclusion of Mark 15:28. The second example that came to my attention as I read through the book is the reference that Watson makes to the intercessory prayer of Christ on the cross, the famous prayer in Luke 23:34a, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And I just did a talk on this passage last year at the Trinitarian Bible Society at a conference in London, and I was defending the authenticity of the passage. And if I had realized it was there in the Eusebian canons, I would have used that as one of my evidences in favor of its early attestation and authenticity. I wasn't aware of it at the time. But as I've already, indicated, Watson points out that this passage, Luke 23:34, the intercessory prayer of Christ from the cross for the people crucifying him, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," is present in the Eusebian canons. It's listed in Canon 10 in the subcanon that has passages that are unique to Luke. So Eusebius's canons recognize that this is a distinctively Lucan account. And it's passage 320, that's the top number. And then the lower number is the canon number is Canon 10. Watson, in his discussion of this, observes the following, quote, "Although the passage is missing from some early manuscripts and may be a later insertion, it was present in Eusebius's text and is identified in his analysis as a passage unique to Luke," end quote, page 156. Watson proceeds then to note that this prayer fits thematically with earlier teaching of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, including Christ's teaching on the love of enemies. And you can look at his analysis on page 156. In fact, whereas Mark 15:28, he seems to say, this is an original, this was a harmonization with Luke. But when he discusses Luke 23:34a, he seems to, although he says it may be an insertion, he seems much more prone to see Luke 23:34 as an original part of the Gospel of Luke. But again, my interest here is simply in the fact that he's pointing out that the Eusebian canons include references to passages that many modern textual critics have rejected as not authentic. So let me just move on now. This is a short podcast today. to offer a few concluding thoughts. I was really intrigued by Watson's insights on what the Eusebian canons reveal to us about ancient understandings of the Gospels. I'm not an expert on the Eusebian canons. I'm just beginning to do a little bit of study to try to understand them better. And I do think it would be a very interesting thing to go through the canons and look more closely at some of the other disputed texts and see what other texts are actually affirmed in the Eusebian canons. So giving us evidence for its usage in the early fourth century. Again, we think that Eusebius died around the year 340. So if this is in his canons, this would be early fourth century where there's a Bible where it has these disputed passages like Mark 15, 28, Luke 23, 34. Now, given, as I already mentioned, Eusebius's letter to Marinus, it's not surprising that Mark 16, 9 through 20 does not appear in his canons. But that's not necessarily evidence. That's not evidence that is conclusive that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is not authentic. Again, we have it in Irenaeus of Lyon. We know that it was being read and accepted as the text of Scripture from the earliest evidences that we have. We know from the letter of Marinus that by the time of Eusebius, there was some controversy about it. And so it's unsurprising, given that Eusebius knew of this controversy, that he might have chosen not to list it in his canon tables. The thing, though, that I find interesting is that the evidence from the canons has not always been consistently used, it seems, by some scholars and apologists. Though I have heard many scholars and apologists cite the absence of Mark 16, 9 through 20 from the Eusebian canons to justify their conclusion that that passage is secondary in nature, I've not heard those same scholars make reference to the presence of disputed passages like Mark 15, 28 and Luke 23, 34a in the Eusebian canons to justify the conclusion that those passages are original and authentic. Although, as I pointed out, it seems that Watson is leaning in the direction of regarding, or at least holding as plausible, that Luke 23, 34a is original. Well, those are just some brief thoughts. This is kind of an ongoing study. I'm looking forward to completing this book, like I said, and hopefully maybe writing a review of it. And I just want to understand better for myself how the Eusebian canons work and what implications there might be in the study of them for understanding how the text of the New Testament was received, and particularly how the traditional text was received among at the earliest layers of Christianity, the earliest layers of extant witnesses to the New Testament. So I'm interested in that, and hopefully I'll do some more study on it. I hope that this little podcast has been helpful today. This episode has been helpful, and I hope that it's encouraging to you. And I will look forward to speaking to you in the next episode of Word Magazine. Till we meet again, take care, and may the Lord richly bless you.